Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel intermedio B2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
Is funny because yes. It's basically, as far as I can tell, doing more harm than good until the middle of the 19th century. And there are a lot of things are quite advanced before the middle of the. I mean, you've got the Industrial Revolution and steam engines, for example, but still, basically, what the doctors are peddling is some nonsense that their predecessors made up. And this whole issue of bleeding, that they're all convinced that bleeding is, you know, that's the first thing you want to do. Not take a couple of paracetamol, but bleed someone.
One.
So I really enjoy writing about children and adolescents, and I love the child's point of view. And when it came to write from the child's Gopi's perspective, again, I realised that things felt more true when I wasn't kind of looking at her from above, but was inhabiting her body somehow, and just noticing and feeling what she noticed and felt in the moment. So that's what I try to do.
Two.
What I like is putting things in order. And what I always wanted to know is what happened before and what happened next. And I've never been so interested in getting deeper in, but I wanted to go broader. Obviously, you have to say, well, it isn't a story. There's no received version. This is all just something that's been pieced together from sources and has been interpreted. And that's an important thing to know in the internet age more than any other. But also, the basics is pretty much agreed on. So why not learn the sequence of rulers and have that broad sense of there was the Norman conquest, and then there was a bit of trying to be in charge of France, and then there was the Wars of the...
Three.
Whenever I get stuck when I'm writing and I don't know how to articulate something, or I can't crystallize a feeling that I want to articulate, I listen to this song because for me, it is every emotion. It is life and death and joy and happiness and love and heartbreak. It is every emotion and every experience and a whole life lived in a song. And it's so much more than a song. It's like an experience, you know, it's everything. And I think it's something that really unlocks me as a writer when I hit a wall or when I can't quite reach into what I need to get to when I need to write.
Four.
And it's interesting we became friends because we met the year she won the Booker Prize and I didn't. And I could have been resentful, but I tell you why I wasn't, because about a week before the Booker Prize, and I didn't know her, I think I'd met her socially once, she dropped me a card and it said, "I think you will win the Booker Prize, and you should." And I thought, what an astonishing thing to write, you know, a week before the great ceremony in the Guildhall. I thought, this is a most unusual woman. Anyway, she did. And so when she won it, I sort of didn't really resent it. And we met, and then we would have lunch every so often.
5. Don't know. I think it's one of those feelings that's universal, the desire for it. But I also think it's a dreadful mistake. I don't think it's anything. You know, I've often fantasized in my head about what I would do to someone that's wronged me. I mean, what I can do now is I can put a nasty version of them in a book and it's a joy. But, you know, you think about it, but it's not a good, it's a terrible thing. It backfires on everybody, I think, that tries it. And it turns you into the kind of person I would never want to be. But I'm sort of fascinated by what would happen if we act on one of those really dark feelings that we have. What would that do to you as a person? How far would you go? I just find it an endlessly sort of fascinating subject, really. I kind of get it out of my system by writing about it.
Six. And as someone who has a PhD in molecular biology, I find science a really limited way of understanding the world. This is just a very limited tool for predicting a few very small things about the future. It doesn't help us understand anything about the world. And if we're going to understand food, the science won't help us with the inequality, the social context, and the immorality of the way our food system works. People say, like, tell me what to do. What should I do? I'm like, I've no idea what you should do. Here is some information, and there aren't clear answers.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract zero.
Is funny because yes. It's basically, as far as I can tell, doing more harm than good until the middle of the 19th century. And there are a lot of things that are quite advanced before the middle of the. I mean, you've got the Industrial Revolution and steam engines, for example, but still, basically, what the doctors are peddling is some nonsense that their predecessors made up. And this whole issue of bleeding, that they're all convinced that bleeding is, you know, that's the first thing you want to do, not take a couple of paracetamol, but bleed someone.
One.
So I really enjoy writing about children and adolescents, and I love the child's point of view. And when it came to write from the child Scoppy's perspective, again, I realised that things felt more true when I wasn't kind of looking at her from above, but was inhabiting her body somehow and just noticing and feeling what she noticed and felt in the moment. So that's what I try to do.
Two.
What I like is putting things in order. And what I always wanted to know is what happened before and what happened next. And I've never been so interested in getting deeper in, but I wanted to go broader. obviously you have to say, well, it isn't a story. There's no received version. This is all just something that's been pieced together from sources and has been interpreted. And that's an important thing to know in the internet age more than any other. But also, the basics is pretty much agreed on. So why not learn the sequence of rulers and have that broad sense of, there was the Norman Conquest, and then there was a bit of trying to be in charge of France, and then there was the Wars of the...
3.
Whenever I get stuck when I'm writing and I don't know how to articulate something, or I can't crystallize a feeling that I want to articulate, I listen to this song, because for me, it is every emotion. It is life and death and joy and happiness and love and heartbreak. It is every emotion and every experience and a whole life lived in a song. And it's so much more than a song. It's like an experience, you know, it's everything. And I think it's something that really unlocks me as a writer when I hit a wall, or when I can't quite reach into what I need to get to when I need to write.
4.
And it's interesting we became friends because we met the year she won the Booker Prize and I didn't. And I could have been resentful, but I tell you why I wasn't, because about a week before the Booker Prize, and I didn't know her, I think I'd met her socially once, she dropped me a card and it said, "I think you will win the Booker Prize, and you should." And I thought, what an astonishing thing to write, you know, a week before the great ceremony in the Guildhall. I thought, this is a most unusual woman. Anyway, she did. And so when she won it, I sort of didn't really resent it. And we met, and then we would have lunch every so often.
5.
Don't know. I think it's one of those feelings that's universal, the desire for it. But I also think it's a dreadful mistake. I don't think it's anything. You know, I've often fantasized in my head about what I would do to someone that's wronged me. I mean, what I can do now is I can put a nasty version of them in a book and it's a joy. But, you know, you think about it, but it's not a good, it's a terrible thing. It backfires on everybody, I think, that tries it. And it turns you into the kind of person I would never want to be. But I'm sort of fascinated by what would happen if we act on one of those really dark feelings that we have. What would that do to you as a person? How far would you go? I just find it an endlessly sort of fascinating subject, really. I kind of get it out of my system by writing about it.
6.
And as someone who has a PhD in molecular biology, I find science a really limited way of understanding the world. This is just a very limited tool for predicting a few very small things about the future. It doesn't help us understand anything about the world. And if we're going to understand food, the science won't help us with the inequality, the social context, and the immorality of the way our food system works. People say, look, tell me what to do. What should I do? I'm like, I've no idea what you should do. Here is some information, and there aren't clear answers.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Now, lots of people are pledging this year to buy no new clothes. If they do, they say they're going to get them second hand or make do with the clothes they have and mend the ones that need it. But sales of clothes at cheap fashion brands like Boohoo.com, Misguided and Pretty Little Thing are booming, despite some of us having second thoughts about the fast fashion industry and its impact. A new book is looking at our obsession with new clothes. It's called How to Break Up with Fast Fashion. Lauren Bravo's a fashion journalist. She wrote it after giving up buying new clothes herself. But I suggested to her that fashion journalists had their part to play in this for feeding the need to follow new styles and trends.
Yes, that is a very good point. I can't deny. In my time, I have certainly been guilty of writing those kinds of articles that make people feel they have to be constantly out shopping for new things. But I think I've changed my ways. And I think that the fashion media is starting to wake up to this problem.
Now, as I said, you gave up buying new clothes for a year, but you bought secondhand ones. And some people listening, they won't have bought any clothes for years. They'll tell us about it and they're proud of it. You could have just made do with the clothes you had, couldn't you?
Yes, that's a very good point. I certainly could have done. I think like many privileged people, I've got far more in my wardrobe than I really need. But I do love clothes. And, you know, I am a passionate defender of fashion as a kind of way of expressing ourselves. I don't think there's anything wrong with loving clothes. It's all about where they're coming from. But it's certainly true. I find that whenever I talk about stopping shopping, I will have a lot of people saying, well, I never buy anything new anyway. What's, you know, there's nothing hard about that. For some people, maybe it isn't. But I think for a lot of people, it is. And we have to recognise that.
Now, your book investigates the roots of fast fashion. I mean, how did the industry, as we know it now, begin?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different theories about when fast fashion began. But in my book, I trace it back to the 1960s and Bieber particularly. So Barbara Hulanicki's kind of iconic fashion brand, which started as a mail order label. People would send off for their dresses. They were designed very quickly. They copied often celebrities. So you could see presenters like Kathy McGowan on the TV. And then the next day you could order her dress from Bieber.
Ready, steady, go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for the first time as well, working class women could buy the latest trends. You know, before that, often people would have had to make their own clothes if they didn't have a lot of money at their disposal. So that kind of democratization of fashion, which fast fashion today is often credited with, I think that can be traced back to the 1960s.
So how did we get so used to cheap clothes? Because it's a question of balancing what you earn with what those clothes cost. And that changed, didn't it?
In the 1970s, my mum had a Saturday job at a jeweller's shop and she earned about £5 a week. And she remembers that the average dress that she would save up for would be maybe £16.99. Mm-hmm. Now, 30 years later, I had a Saturday job at a local library. I earned about £50 a week and I could still buy a dress for £16.99. So, you know, when you think about it that way, it really illustrates how fashion has got so much cheaper. A lot of clothing production got outsourced, offshored over to the developing world. So countries like Indonesia, India, Bangladesh and China are now responsible for making the vast bulk of all the clothes that are sold in the UK. And with that, we've seen what we call chasing the cheapest needle around the world. So the fashion industry constantly looking to undercut competitors. And with that, clothes getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
There are a lot of concerns in your book, and that's one of them, that often the conditions are bad. There have been some terrible accidents. I mean, what were the issues with this whole industry that made you actually want to stop buying and write the book?
Well, it was a combination of things. I mean, it was certainly the humanitarian issues that we know about, although I think most people probably don't know enough about. The Rana Plaza collapse of 2013, I think, really made the headlines, but most people still don't know the kind of exploitation that really goes on in the garment industry. It was also the environmental factors, you know, like so many people at the moment, I am sort of waking up to that real panic of climate change and reading stats like, you know, the fashion industry has a larger carbon footprint than flying and shipping combined. And there was also...
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Now, lots of people are pledging this year to buy no new clothes. If they do, they say they're going to get them second hand or make do with the clothes they have and mend the ones that need it. But sales of clothes at cheap fashion brands like Boohoo.com, Misguided and Pretty Little Thing are booming despite some of us having second thoughts about the fast fashion industry and its impact. A new book is looking at our obsession with new clothes. It's called How to Break Up with Fast Fashion. Lauren Bravo's a fashion journalist. She wrote it after giving up buying new clothes herself. But I suggested to her that fashion journalists had their part to play in this for feeding the need to follow new styles and trends.
Yes, that is a very good point. I can't deny. In my time, I have certainly been guilty of writing those kinds of articles that make people feel they have to be constantly out shopping for new things. But I think I've changed my ways, and I think that the fashion media is starting to wake up to this problem.
Now, as I said, you gave up buying new clothes for a year, but you bought second-hand ones, and some people listening, they won't have bought any clothes for years. They'll tell us about it, and they're proud of it. You could have just made do with the clothes you had, couldn't you?
Yes, that's a very good point. I certainly could have done. I think, like many privileged people, I've got far more in my wardrobe than I really need. But I do love clothes. And, you know, I am a passionate defender of fashion as a kind of way of expressing ourselves. I don't think there's anything wrong with loving clothes. It's all about where they're coming from. But it's certainly true. I find that whenever I talk about stopping shopping, I will have a lot of people saying, well, I never buy anything new anyway. What's, you know, there's nothing hard about that. For some people, maybe it isn't. But I think for a lot of people, it is. And we have to recognise that.
Now, your book investigates the roots of fast fashion. I mean, how did the industry as we know it now begin?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of different theories about when fast fashion began, but in my book, I trace it back to the 1960s and Bieber particularly. So Barbara Hulanicki's kind of iconic fashion brand, which started as a mail order label. People would send off for their dresses. They were designed very quickly. They copied often celebrities. So you could see presenters like Kathy McGowan on the TV. And then the next day you could order her dress from Bieber.
Ready, steady, go.
Exactly.
Basically. The presenter.
Yeah. And for the first time as well, working class women could buy the latest trends. You know, before that, often people would have had to make their own clothes if they didn't have a lot of money at their disposal. So that kind of democratization of fashion, which fast fashion today is often credited with, I think that can be traced back to the 1960s.
So how did we get so used to cheap clothes? Because it's a question of balancing what you earned with what those clothes cost. And that changed, didn't it?
In the 1970s, my mum had a Saturday job at a jeweller's shop and she earned about £5 a week. And she remembers that the average dress that she would save up for would be maybe £16.99. Mm-hmm. Now, 30 years later, I had a Saturday job at a local library. I earned about £50 a week and I could still buy a dress for £16.99. So, you know, when you think about it that way, it really illustrates how fashion has got so much cheaper. A lot of clothing production got outsourced, offshored over to the developing world. So countries like Indonesia, India, Bangladesh and China are now responsible for making the vast bulk of all the clothes that are sold in the UK. And with that, we've seen what we call chasing the cheapest needle around the world. So the fashion industry constantly looking to undercut competitors. And with that, clothes getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
There are a lot of concerns in your book, and that's one of them, that often the conditions are bad. There have been some terrible accidents. I mean, what were the issues with this whole industry that made you actually want to stop buying and write the book?
Well, it was a combination of things. I mean, it was certainly the humanitarian issues that we know about, although I think most people probably don't know enough about. The Rana Plaza collapse of 2013, I think, really made the headlines, but most people still don't know the kind of exploitation that really goes on in the garment industry. It was also the environmental factors, you know, like so many people at the moment, I am sort of waking up to that real panic of climate change and reading stats like, you know, the fashion industry has a larger carbon footprint than flying and shipping combined. And there was also...
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Catch me or I go Houdini. Houdini is a song that I wrote last November. And last year, while I was on tour, intermittently in between each leg of the tour, I would go to the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was doing, like, most of my writing. Yeah, I had just finished, like, my Australian leg of the tour, and I flew straight to LA to work with Kevin and Caroline and Tobias. And we had a couple days. I had some, like, promos, some other bits and stuff. And a few days before, we'd gone into kind of, like, a big studio in LA. And I'd been so used to working in here in London. And this whole room, it's got, like, a much more cozy feeling with, like, beams and windows, and you can see outside. And in LA, which should really be the place where you'd have, like, windows and you can see outside, and it was actually a very, like, dark room. And we were writing for a day, and I just wasn't getting anything. And I was just like, I feel like in this room, my ideas just don't have, like, space to breathe, or I feel like I need to be able to move around and look out the window and that kind of thing. And then Kevin said, oh, well, I've got, you know, a small little studio in my house. Like, why don't we just move there and see how we go? And so we went there, and we started working on a song, and it went really, really well. Kevin was on the computer, and he was kind of like working on the monitors and the sound, and just to make sure that he can, like, hear properly. And he just played a track that he'd made, and he was playing some stuff, and I was like, wait a second. I was like, what is that sound? And it was the da 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 in the beginning of, and I was immediately hooked. I was like, no, you have to pull that file up. Like, I need to listen to it. He's like, oh, it's just an idea that I kind of started, but it needs a lot of work. Like, we can build it if you really like it. But I was instantly inspired by it, and I was like, all right, let's work on this track. It felt good. And the whole essence of the song really kind of, I guess, came together in the first 2 hours of writing. And the first thing that came was the chorus. And the chorus, which to me, I think, is more of a chant, I guess. It was a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So anyway, I lived with the song for a little while, and then we came back to, well, I was in London because it was like I'd finished my tour, and then towards like the end of January, we all got back here in this room to finish off Houdini. That day, Kevin had woken up. I guess it was really like he had rolled out of bed, jumped in the shower, and he had just made like a voice note, and he sent it to me. And he was like, oh, I've got an idea for like a middle eight. Like, what if it goes like, da, na, na, da, 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 da. And I was just immediately like, I was like, oh, this sounds really cool, but I think I'd have to hear it. Cause I, you know, it felt like a little bit of a departure in a way, but it gave the song just the exact amount of lightness that it needed to just help it grow into like a fully formed song. It gives it that really like euphoric feeling. It's that moment that when you're dancing, when it's like, oh, I'm like releasing everything in that moment. And I love going out to dance, and like really going out to dance. And I felt like I needed a song that mirrored.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas.
Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Genie is a song that I wrote last November. And last year, while I was on tour, intermittently in between each leg of the tour, I would go to the studio. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was doing, like, most of my writing. Yeah, I had just finished, like, my Australian leg of the tour, and I flew straight to LA to work with Kevin and Caroline and Tobias. And we had a couple days. I had some, like, promos, some other bits and stuff. And a few days before, we'd gone into kind of, like, a big studio in LA. And I'd been so used to working in here in London. And this whole room, it's got, like, a much more cozy feeling with, like, beams and windows, and you can see outside. And in LA, which should really be the place where you'd have, like, windows and you can see outside, and it was actually a very, like, dark room. And we were writing for a day, and I just wasn't getting anything. And I was just like, I feel like in this room, my ideas just don't have, like, space to breathe, or I feel like I need to be able to move around and look out the window and that kind of thing. And then Kevin said, oh, well, I've got, you know, a small little studio in my house. Like, why don't we just move there and see how we go? And so we went there, and we started working on a song, and it went really, really well. Kevin was on the computer, and he was kind of like working on the monitors and the sound, and just to make sure that he can, like, hear properly. And he just played a track that he'd made, and he was playing some stuff, and I was like, wait a second. I was like, what is that sound? And it was the da 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 in the beginning of, and I was immediately hooked. I was like, no, you have to pull that file up. Like, I need to listen to it. He's like, oh, it's just an idea that I kind of started, but it needs a lot of work. Like, we can build it if you really like it. But I was instantly inspired by it, and I was like, all right, let's work on this track. It felt good. And the whole essence of the song really kind of, I guess, came together in the first 2 hours of writing. And the first thing that came was the chorus. And the chorus, which to me, I think, is more of a chant, I guess. It was a da 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 da. So anyway, I lived with the song for a little while, and then we came back to, well, I was in London because it was like I'd finished my tour, and then towards like the end of January, we all got back here in this room to finish off Houdini. That day, Kevin had woken up. I guess it was really like he had rolled out of bed, jumped in the shower, and he had just made like a voice note, and he sent it to me. And he was like, oh, I've got an idea for like a middle eight. Like, what if it goes like, da, na, na, da, 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 da. And I was just immediately like, I was like, oh, this sounds really cool, but I think I'd have to hear it. Cause I, you know, it felt like a little bit of a departure in a way, but it gave the song just the exact amount of lightness that it needed to just help it grow into like a fully formed song. It gives it that really like euphoric feeling. It's that moment that when you're dancing, when it's like, oh, I'm like releasing everything in that moment. And I love going out to dance, and like really going out to dance. And I felt like I needed a song that mirrored.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3.
Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.